danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 270 of the Thinking Poker Podcast in Catonsville, Maryland. I'm Andrew Brokus. I will be joined shortly by Nate Mavis and by our guest, Derek Tenbush, whom you may also know as Killing Bird. But I'll be doing the strategy segment by myself. And let me introduce you first to Derek, for those who don't know. Derek was one of our earliest guests on the Thinking Poker Podcast. He's one of the owners of Tournament Poker Edge, which, as many of you know, is our strategy sponsor here on the Thinking Poker Podcast. So we'll be talking to Derek about how he got started with Tournament Poker Edge to some degree, although we did discuss that in our first interview. More so, we'll be talking about where he sees Tournament Poker Edge fitting into the increasingly crowded market of poker training materials, and also about his personal life, which is pretty interesting. He recently moved to Las Vegas and is getting ready to move back to North Carolina. He fosters rescue beagles, or fosters beagles, I guess. They are rescued in many cases. He has a history of fostering beagles and a deep involvement with a beagle rescue organization. We'll talk to him a good deal about that. So yeah, all of that and more coming up with Derek Tenbush in just a moment. Oh, and Derek also streams on Twitch. We'll talk about this during the interview, but twitch.tv/killingbird. Want to make sure I get that out there for you. Tournament Poker Edge is, as I mentioned, our strategy sponsor. You'll hear plenty more about it in today's episode, but I do want to emphasize how useful it is to have a learning community when you're trying to get better at poker. It's a really difficult thing to do by yourself for a variety of reasons, including that it's just extremely isolating and frustrating when you're out there playing poker, whether on a virtual or a live felt. It's every man for himself. It's dog eat dog. And it's nice to be in a cooperative relationship with other poker players sometimes, which is one of the things that you'll get on Tournament Poker Edge, an engaged community on the forums and elsewhere. Other people who are learning alongside of you. You can bounce ideas and questions and get other people's opinions, see how they're thinking about hands. All these so useful to get other ideas inside your head, because the immediate feedback that you get from the results of hands that you play is not terribly reliable. So you can sign up for all of that and more at www.tournamentpokeredge.com. Our strategy question today is coming from Shoki. And boy, I hope I pronounced that correctly, because Shoki actually thanks us in his email. He says, "I'm surprised how you always get the pronunciation correct with my name on the podcast." And the truth is, I don't remember pronouncing Shoki's name on the podcast before, so now I'm doubly paranoid about whether or not I'm pronouncing it correctly. Hopefully I am. Apologies if I'm not. Shoki says, "Hi, Andrew and Nate. Love your podcast. I played a lot of micro MTTs back during college, but now that I'm working, I'm playing a 5NL Zoom on PokerStars, and I have a question from there about playing sets. Here's the hand in question." This is a 2-cent, 5-cent Zoom game. Our hero here is pretty deep, has 2353 in front of him, so over 450 big blinds. The opponent in the hand, under the gun, has only about 100 big blinds, so that's really our effective stack here. So the under-the-gun player opens to 16 cents, and the hero is in middle position with pocket twos, specifically the two of hearts and the two of clubs. Shoki says, "I call here with 2-2, looking purely to set mine. Under-the-gun seems like a rig, playing a solid strategy. He's 18 VPIP, 17 preflop raise, 13.3% 3-bet over 166 hands. And I expect his opening range to be pretty tight, maybe sevens plus, ace-jack off plus, suited broadways, king-queen offsuit." So right away, I mean, I think Shoki is probably not even intending to ask about this part of the hand, but I actually think this is already a mistake. I think that set mining, the people really overestimate the value of set mining. I think, you know, essentially the way to think about this is you're going to need to win on average 10 times your preflop investment. And that might seem pretty doable. Right? If Under the Gun has $5 and you're only investing 16 cents to win the pot, you know, it might seem like, okay, well, I can win 30 times, more than 30 times my investment if I flop a set. And so you need to ask yourself, you know, how often am I really going to get stacks in if I flop a set? I don't think it's guaranteed, even if you manage to flop a set versus an overpair, you know, if your read is that this player is a solid regular, like, I don't think that's an automatic stack. I think that depends a lot on the board. You know, when you get pocket twos, it does happen that you get set under set. I mean, that's a non-trivial thing. A lot of times when all the money goes in, your opponent doesn't have an overpair. Your opponent has some kind of, you know, big draw, possibly even, you know, a made straight can be a problem for you, or a flush. You get the money in on the turn when you have a set, and it's possible your opponent's going to already have a straight or a flush, or, you know, he's going to have a draw of some sort that has actually a lot more equity than an overpair would. So I think it's really a stretch to say that, you know, you're going to get anywhere near a full stack, anywhere near all the time. Now, all of that said, you know, still, there's sort of three times as much as you need to win in the effective stack. So maybe it seems like you've got a pretty nice buffer there. But particularly when you're calling in middle position, there's a few other things that can go wrong. You can have other players re-raise. That's a particularly bad outcome. So now you're not seeing the flop anymore for 16 cents. Either you're paying even more to see the flop, or you're going to end up folding. And you just lose your 16 cents, lose your three big blinds. Even having other players call behind you isn't necessarily good. You know, the kinds of hands that they're calling with aren't really, in many cases, the kinds of hands they're going to... I mean, it sort of depends on how well those players are going to play after the flop. But I would say, in general, it's not really good for you to have a player in position calling behind. What ends up happening in this hand, actually, is that the button calls. And Shoki says it was great seeing the button call to inflate the pot early. Well, yeah, it does make the pot larger, but it also... So now it's a new thing that Under the Gun needs to be scared of, right? Under the Gun should be less inclined to stack off with an overpair in a three-way pot than he would be in a heads-up pot. Yeah, on the one hand, the pot is larger, so the stack-to-pot ratio is lower, but he also has to worry about two hands rather than one, and you know, and he knows that you have to worry about two hands. So just, you're going to have to show more strength when you put money in the pot after the flop. He should be a little more reluctant to put money in the pot after the flop. The third player in the pot doesn't necessarily help you. Also, the third player in the pot has cards in his hand, and those cards are not necessarily cards that pocket twos plays that well against. Like, let's say the button overcalls here with 10-8 suited. You know, every once in a while you get the 10-8 deuce flop, and you put some money in pretty good. But even there, you know, he has like a 10% chance of winning that pot. But even so, you know, that's not the most common outcome. A flop like 9-7 deuce, that's not that great for you when you have twos versus 10-8. I mean, yeah, you're going to win a bet or two a decent amount of the time, but I also think there's a fair number of situations where you end up getting stacked on that board because he makes a straight and you don't get away from your set. I think the kinds of hands that the button is overcalling with are not really the kinds of hands. Like, when you have a set, what you want is for your opponent to have an overpair or to have top pair. You know, those kinds of hands that will seem very strong, but that are actually drawing very, very slim against a pocket pair. Getting the money in against a draw, certainly getting the money in against a straight or a flush, those things aren't really good for you when you have a set. The final thing that's important to consider when you're playing, especially when you're playing micro stakes like this, is that the rake is really significant. I'm not entirely sure what PokerStars is going to pull out of this pot, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be a lot. So there's really a high price to pay for seeing a flop. And I'm pretty sure the way it works on PokerStars is a no flop, no drop situation. So if you don't end up seeing a flop, like if you were to three bet, and I'm not saying you should three bet with twos, but I think one of the reasons why you see the Under the Gun having a, you know, relatively high three bet of 13% is that if you're going to play the micro stakes, you really don't want to do a lot of calling. You want to be doing a lot of three betting and a lot of folding. And the reason for that is that there's a pretty high penalty for going to a flop, and that needs to be taken into consideration here. Either, you know, even if in a world without rake, this would be a kind of marginal call, once we add in rake, this is going to become a significantly losing call. Honestly, I don't even think calling here on the button would be a good idea, but I certainly don't want to call with this hand in middle position. I think you need a much better hand to call here. I think you need like pocket eights or something like that to call in this situation. And once your pocket pair gets much better than eights, you probably want to start three-betting it for the reasons that I gave. Cold calling in middle position is just not something you should be doing very often at all with any kind of hand, let alone with pocket twos. Okay, that said, we do end up going to a flop. So we have under the gun raising to 16 cents. Hero calls in middle position with pocket twos. Button calls. We go to the flop. Three of spades, eight of clubs, two of diamonds. It says there's 55 cents in the pot, so I guess PokerStars hasn't taken their rake yet. Our hero does flop bottom set. It's a rainbow flop. Under the gun bets 18 cents. Hero calls, button calls. Shoki says, here I am happy to see the two come, and I have the option of calling or raising. Heads up, with the under the gun, I might have raised, but three-way I decided to call to see if I could keep the button in the pot with weird holdings. Also, I think under the gun will fold a lot of overcards to a raise for me three-way, so it gives him the option to bet again on the turn, while I think I can still get stacks in against jacks at plus at some point anyway. I think Shoki's considering a lot of good things here. The most important one is that he's got a value target, right? He knows, I want my opponent to have jacks. I think that I can get money in against jacks later, even if I just call the flop now. That's really the critical question. You know, if the opponent has two unpaired overcards, then we would prefer to call and give him a chance to, you know, either bluff the next street or improve to top pair before we start putting money into the pot. If the opponent has an overpair, then we might have a little bit more of an interest in raising the flop now to try to build the pot against the overpair before the board gets scary. Or, you know, if he has pocket jacks and the turn is a king, that's going to hurt your action a lot. So there's sort of a trade-off here of, you know, the ideal play against overcards might not be the ideal play against an overpair. There's a few things to weigh. First is, how likely do you think it is that he's c-betting overcards into two players on this board? It's probably pretty plausible. So I think that keeping a lot of overcards in his range seems reasonable. And then you just sort of have to weigh, you know, how good is calling versus overcards? And I would say it's very good relative to raising. And how much am I giving up by calling versus raising when my opponent has an overpair? And I would say you're probably not giving up that much. And I think Shoki's doing that assessment well. So I think that calling here is fine. I don't think that dragging the button into the pot is as big of a deal as Shoki thinks it is. And this, again, comes back to what kind of hand the button is likely to have. So he says, I just want to drag the button in with weird holdings. I'm not sure entirely what that would be. If we're thinking of something like 10-9 of spades, yeah, so he's, you know, where he has two backdoor draws and maybe he's thinking he has two live overcards. I mean, it's probably not a good call on the button's part, but even if he makes that call, you're winning a decent amount of that flop bet, you know, the 18 cents that goes into the pot on the flop, you know, a good amount of that is going to you. But after that, I think the button, when he has 10-9 of spades, is going to play pretty well against you. Like, if he doesn't turn a draw, he's going to be out. If he does turn a draw, then you're not going to put that money in that well on the turn. And on the river, you're actually going to be at a disadvantage, unless the board pairs. On the river, you're sort of, the money's probably only going to go in if you are behind. So I think that, you know, letting him come into the pot, it's not bad to let him come in with 10-9 of spades, but I don't think it's that important of a consideration. I think he just doesn't come along that often, period. I mean, if he, for the most part, he's, whether or not he comes along is going to have to do with his cards and not to do with whether or not you call or raise. Like, I don't think there's a lot of hands where you win a lot more money from him as a result of calling the flop rather than raising. It's kind of a question of whether you squeeze an extra one-third pot bet out of him right now by calling. So I do think the call is fine. I just wanted to emphasize, I think it's a lot more about, we should be much more focused on trying to stack under the gun than we should be on trying to drag button along with us. The hero calls the 18 cent bet, and the button also calls. So we go to the turn with $1.09 now in the pot, and the turn is the 10 of clubs. So we're looking now at 3 of spades, 8 of clubs, deuce of diamonds, and our hero holding pocket twos without a club. There is now a club draw on the board. Under the gun bets 80 cents. Hero just calls again. Hero says, here I was surprised by the larger bet, but I think eights and tens plus still play like this. Maybe some of his suited club Broadway cards, but I discount it slightly as I wasn't sure if he'd raise so big with those. This is the part of the hand where I think I could have played better. Villain has three combos of tens and eights, and I think I can discount some of his 3-3s since I don't think he opens all of them under the gun. I think we beat aces through jacks, where there are 24 combos in total, so I think we still beat his calling range at this point, assuming the typical 5NL rig just calls off with jacks through aces here. My reasoning at the time for calling was that I can get stacks in against many overpairs anyway, which he has big mistake because a lot of scare cards slow down the action, and I decided to call instead. And I agree that calling here is probably a mistake. I think Shoki's largely right that it's a stretch to assume you're just going to stack over pairs on the river. And right now, it's a lot more likely to stack over pairs. I also think it's really telling, though, that already on the turn, he's starting to wonder, you know, he's starting to consider the possibility of higher sets, and he's saying, well, I guess I'm ahead if all the money goes in. And what a big change this is from preflop, where preflop, we're kind of thinking, like, hey, if I flop a set, I'm going to win a big pot. And then here we are, we flopped the set, and we're actually starting to feel a little uncomfortable about putting this much money into the pot. And this is a part of the problem with flopping bottom set. You know, the bigger sets are typically going to be in other people's ranges, and especially if you're not sure whether they're going to stack off with overpairs, then you know your equity when all the money goes in is not actually that great. I mean, I think this is really just highlights the problem with trying to set mine against a confident player. I mean, it's one thing to set mine against someone who's just putting way too much money in the pot, never really going to think about folding an overpair or top pair. But I think it's not that easy to get 100 big blinds in against a decent player. And, you know, I mean, it's not that you're not going to be in okay shape, but for it being your best case scenario where, like, you're really hoping to flop that set and then you're really hoping to get all the money in, I don't think it's anywhere near, you know, an automatic stack when that happens. I think you lose a fair number of those pots where all the money goes in. And then there's a fair number of times when you win small to medium pots with a set, but that's not really enough to justify, you know, given how rarely you flop a set and how hard it is to win the pot if you don't flop a set. I also think it's worth pointing out, you know, Shoki kind of says he doesn't see a lot of downside to calling. In the, like, he's still kind of, at least in the moment, he didn't see a lot of downside to calling, thinking that he's still going to get stacks from overpairs on the river. And setting aside that that's an optimistic assumption, I also don't see what the upside is to calling. Like, if you think your opponent can have an overpair and you think he's going to stack off with them now, why not raise? Like, what's the benefit of just calling? On the flop, we were thinking, well, maybe by just calling, we can keep his overcards in his range. But it doesn't seem like at this point, Shoki's really expecting overcards. Like, the villain is betting 80 cents on the turn with just a, you know, random ace-jack offsuit or something. It doesn't seem like Shoki really expects those to be in his range. So what's the upside of calling here? So, I understand the upside of raising is you try to stack over pairs. And even if you were to assume that you can still stack over pairs on a lot of rivers, what's the benefit of waiting to the river? Like, how does the situation get better for you on the river? And I also think you need to be a little worried about under the gun here. About a button here. Not about him having a better hand, but just about letting him draw at this point. Like, if you do think that he's peeling the flop with random, you know, backdoor draws or whatever, like, a fair number of those picked something up here on the turn, and you don't necessarily want to give him a profitable call with those. I'm not sure what other hands the button's overcalling with. I mean, if you have some reason to think that he's, like, particularly loose or something, so I guess he's playing at a 5NL table. Maybe that's the reason to think that he's particularly loose, but I don't know that, you know, bringing the button along here, I don't know that you're really doing that well against buttons overcalling range. Not that Shoki mentioned that, I just thought maybe I should. Okay, so Shoki does call, the button folds. We go to the river, $2.69 in the pot. The river is the king of spades, making the final board 3 of spades, 8 of clubs, deuce of diamonds, 10 of clubs, king of spades, our hero holding pocket twos. Under the gun bets $1.39, which is just over half the pot. And Shoki says, my initial thought was to shove most rivers against bets, but I'm suddenly scared of this bet here. I think his betting range consists of ace-king of clubs, pocket aces, king-queen of clubs, king-jack of clubs, kings-tens-eights. We beat 7 combos and lose the 9, so we still have the price to call, but not a sufficient price to raise, especially as the opponent might fold king-jack and king-queen to the raise. So I do agree with just calling here, and I think Shoki's reasoning for it is good. I'll just add that, you know, this again is why, A, you want to get the money in earlier when you have a set before the board gets scarier for you, and B, you just don't want to be set mining in the first place. Like, you hit your hand. You got the literal best case scenario for your hand. no straights you're worried about, no flushes you're worried about. You made the set and you're still not able to put all the money in. I mean, I think that I don't know that you can underscore any better why set mining is just kind of not that great. if that's literally the only thing your hand has going on for it. As you start to improve your hand, you have pocket eights and you call this raise from under the gun. It's still in many cases a set mine, but you have a little bit more chance of winning the pot unimproved when you have pocket eights. You have a little bit more chance of making straight when you have pocket eights. There's a little bit more going on for you. And then, of course, as your pair gets better, then that gets better. If you're calling from the big blind, now you're getting a better price to call, and so it's a little bit more justifiable. But just cold calling in middle position with a small pair, I think this hand really highlights why that's not that desirable. And the results, Shoki ends up losing to pocket eights. Which has a set. He says, as played, I like my river call, but I feel like I should have raised the turn in hindsight, even though I would have lost more money doing that. I think above is a very simple but effective approach I am trying to use to go up the ladders in Zoom, but I would love to hear you discuss the hand, because I always learn a lot from your long discussion, even on the simpler hands. So sorry to say you won't be hearing from both of us, but hopefully I've chewed you out sufficiently. The one thing that I will say that I think is to your credit, Shoki, is that you're considering, I don't think you're being too results-oriented here. You know, it's not like Shoki's saying, oh, maybe I should have folded the turn since I ran into a higher set. I mean, he's actually considering a line that would have resulted in him losing even more money. So I think it's good that he is actually considering the opponent's range rather than just looking at the results of the hand and saying, how could I have avoided losing this big pot to a set of eights? So I think that's really good. But yeah, I guess I've said it enough times. I would fold preflop. Thank you for writing, Shoki, and hopefully I got your pronunciation correct again. Derek Kenbush, thank you so much. Is Derek, it seems like everyone in the poker world just calls you KB.
Yeah, it is. Actually, somebody was asking me the other day, what do I call you? And I said, well, Derek, what else would you call me? And I was like, oh, yeah. Because most people do call me KB, but either are completely fine.
Yeah, and I feel weird when I'm talking to Carlos. I'll say, Derek said this. He's like, who's Derek? Oh, KB, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. For some reason, I just haven't really gotten used to it, even though it's been, 7 or 8 years of being called that. But
well,
it's whatever.
Kind of weird too, because as we discussed the first time you were on the show, Killing Bird is a band that you were in. I assume you were not the only band member, so it must be kind of weird to now have that as your personal identity.
Yeah, in fact, I actually really regret it. I picked that name because when I signed up for my first poker account, I didn't really care about poker. I just had watched Moneymaker or something, and I was like, oh, I wanna try that. And I thought, well, I'll just use my band name so that maybe somebody will say, hey, what's your name mean? And then I can say it's my band and maybe they'll buy my record. Oh, like that was
I
my
walked
whole
right
goal
into your trap.
Yeah. So for everybody out there listening now. But now it's I Google that name to see if there's any new stuff about me out there, and I just find band news mixed with poker news, and it's really frustrating, but it's too late to go back now. So
yeah, in terms of regrettable poker usernames, I think that's pretty low on the list.
Yeah, I've definitely seen, in fact, I always joke with Mark and Carlos and guys like that, because you'll see names and then you're like, what if they win the main event or something, and they're gonna be like, you know, this guy's name is insert incredibly offensive name here.
Yeah, I think that happened. Monster Dong won an FTOP event, yeah. And they had to put that on their blog.
I remember when a Dude Man 420 won the Sunday Million, and Poker Stars just had to find out his real name and just use that on all their weekly press material.
Yeah, and even those are relatively mild to some that I've seen, especially on sites that aren't as good about monitoring their usernames for, appropriateness.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But yeah, but it's it is what it is. I embrace it now, I guess.
Yeah, there was kind of interesting. Someone had the screen name. I think this is on Full Tilt.
I hate Juice, J-U-I-C-E.
Oh, yeah.
And someone reported that, and then he was claiming that it was a criticism of Rake, right, which is often called Juice, which I think is actually not... I mean, I'm kind of credulous. It doesn't seem completely implausible to me, but I thought that was sort of an interesting case of whether or not that was an acceptable screen name.
I mean, at least he used that excuse as opposed to, like, I really hate orange juice. Yeah. Then I'd be like, come on, man. Nobody hates orange juice that much.
So a lot's happened since the last time that we spoke to you. I guess we can start with your personal life, because it seems like you've got some stuff going on there. So you recently moved to Las Vegas. I think you've been there for about 6 months. I mean, what prompted that?
Yeah, so basically we had been talking about moving for a long time, and then my son went off to college, and we're like, okay, perfect time to move. And then we said, well, let's give him like a year or whatever to like settle in and just, you know, make sure he's good or whatever, and then we'll find some place to move. And then the next thing we knew, it was his senior year. And we were just like, why, you know, what are we waiting for? And we, you know, as many people do when their kids leave, like all of a sudden you have like more house than you need, and you're you know, you hate cleaning it and taking care of it or whatever. And we're just like, all right, we got to get out of here. So we'll, you know, let's sell the house. And I'm like, okay, well, where are we going to go? Like, are we going to stay here? Are we going to go somewhere? And we finally just said, okay, let's go out and we'll go to dinner. We'll have a couple of drinks, and we'll have to have decided before we go home what we're doing, because we just kept putting it off. So we kind of talked about a bunch of different places. We discussed like places like Austin and Portland and a few other, like, I guess, hip, cool places to move these days. Like, we picked all the trendy spots. And then at some point my wife was like, oh, you know, would it be helpful for like your business or whatever to move to Vegas? And I said, well, I mean, yeah, like, it's mildly plus EV probably, but I don't really plan on playing a lot of live poker, so Vegas isn't like important or anything. But yeah, I'm sure I could make some new connections or whatever. And she said, all right, let's move to Vegas. And I'm like, wait, what? So a lot of people were like, how did you con your wife into moving to Vegas? And I'm like, I didn't. Like, it was honestly mostly her idea. I mean, I didn't fight it or anything, but but then as life often does, we got a slight curveball thrown. So we were here. We actually made an offer on a house like in our first month here, and fortunately they accepted somebody else's offer. So we just were still renting our house, and then I got an opportunity to go be involved with a distillery, which a lot of people know I enjoy my craft beer and I enjoy my craft spirits. So I got an opportunity to go do marketing for a distillery, which is back in North Carolina. So so we're sort of preparing ourselves. And it's funny because not only did we sell our house, but we essentially sold everything or gave away or donated pretty much everything we owned.
Yeah.
So yeah, everything we have, for the most part, there's a couple of things in a storage unit that were like family heirlooms and stuff that we didn't want to get rid of. But for the most part, everything we own fits in my Jeep Wrangler. So we got rid of everything, and now we're just going back to where we came from. So, we're already like furniture shopping, and I'm like, we had a nice couch, damn it. But it's exciting, you know. We had a good time, and my wife and I just joke like, well, that was a nice, you know, 8 month long vacation. It was cool, but it was fun. But Vegas will no longer be my home in about 2 months, so.
You got to be in your own house during the World Series of Poker. That's an experience not a lot of people get.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, at first I was like, oh, this is going to kind of suck. You know, like, I don't have anybody to go back and, like, tell my bad beat stories to, or, like, you know, to ask me about hands or to share hands with or anything. Like, it's just kind of like, won't be quite the same, because that's what it's been for the last...
That sounds like a plus to me.
I know, that's what ended up happening.
No one's sharing bad beat stories with you either.
Yeah, it was great. Like, all of a sudden I was like, you know, it's actually kind of nice just coming home and like turning on SportsCenter and eating a pizza, like, and not thinking or talking about poker. So kind of, you know, obviously you miss some of that like camaraderie and the hijinks and stuff that go on when you're living in a house with five other people or whatever. But it was actually kind of a nice way to break away from it a little more than you even do when you're in the old situation. So yeah, so it worked out pretty good. Can't complain too much. I've played, like, other than the World Series, I've played so little live poker. I think I've played 3 live tournaments since I've lived here, which has been about 6 months.
Wow.
So, but I've played a lot more online poker, so it's kind of worked out in that regard.
Yeah, and you're not really a cash guy at all.
No, like, everybody keeps telling me, oh man, you know, you got to go hit Red Rock, or you got to go hit this place or that place, and I'm like, no, I don't. Like, oh yeah, I put in a 15-hour session the other day and won 400 or whatever. I'm like, out. I'm out. I'm like, do they have really comfortable DX Racer chairs, and can I play in my pajamas? If the answer is no, I'm out.
And it seems like, I guess maybe we talked a little bit about Twitch the last time you were on here, but it seems like you've gotten pretty into that community, and you know, that's a thing that you enjoy doing.
Yeah, I was actually trying to remember, like an hour before I got on this morning, I was trying to remember if I was streaming at the time we talked last, and then
you,
I was like,
you were one of our very first guys. I think you're like episode 14 or something. I mean, it's been damn near 6 years since you've been on the show.
Yeah, it's been a long time. So I think maybe I had been watching it but not streaming, or I can't really remember. But yeah, it's definitely something that I do a lot more of now, and I definitely enjoy it. It's kind of interesting because it's like, I think a lot of people assume that maybe Twitch is a big competitor to what we do at Tournament Poker Edge, but we haven't really found that to be the case yet. I can see that becoming the case someday, but as of now, it doesn't seem to really be that much of an impact. But more than anything, I just enjoy like this, because I've always liked poker more for the exact same reasons I liked music, if that makes any sense. Well, hopefully it'll make sense after I say this. I like the community aspect of all of this more than I like the actual act of playing poker. Yeah. So for me, like when I was in the music industry, or when I was a music fan even, like what I loved more was like sitting around like opening up album sleeves and like talking through lyrics and, you know, talking about our favorite concerts and things like that. That's kind of what I like about poker more too. Like, to me, sitting around with a bunch of people and talking about poker is actually more exciting to me than playing poker, which sort of makes Twitch perfect. So like, I don't do a lot of strategy on my stream. I don't do a lot of like in-depth analysis or anything. It's more just like a bunch of people playing poker together and chatting about it while we do it, and you know, occasionally cracking a beer or two, and also like Twitch has kind of allowed me to like to sort of work that marketing muscle that I'm so infatuated with, because it's like growing a whole new business almost. Mm-hmm. Even though I don't foresee it being like a career or anything, but I kind of treat it like it could be. So that's been kind of enjoyable too, just kind of like seeing, you know, how many new followers did we get, how many new subscribers did we get, etc. So it's been a lot of fun. Been enjoying it.
Before I forget to ask, what's your Twitch name for people who want to go in there and watch you?
It is twitch.tv/killingbird.
And you're streaming mostly like small mid-stakes online tournaments?
Yeah, for the most part. I stream like 3 or 4 nights a week usually, and do pretty much anything from like $5 to $55, typically in that range. You know, sometimes they'll run like the special $1 million Sundays or whatever, and I'll play those. But pretty much, small to mid-stakes.
What does marketing look like for that? I mean, how are you trying to distinguish yourself within the Twitch space?
So I, like, one thing I've been trying to do is sort of think, I'm trying to look at it a little differently than a lot of people have. So a lot of people have taken like sort of the normal route of, you know, obviously streaming a lot and utilizing Twitter and stuff to promote their stream, and using YouTube as well. So they'll do like highlight reels and things like that and put it up on YouTube, hopefully directing people back to their stream. So what I've kind of done, even though I do have a YouTube channel, and of course I use Twitter to promote my stream, I've kind of started to try to think of ways that nobody else is really doing. And I don't even know if any of them are working. So I've been like toying with like Facebook advertising and promoted posts, things like that. And I've also been trying to do more like in the sort of real life space. So like almost going back to like the old school music business days of like handing out flyers or samplers or stickers outside of clubs.
Oh, wow.
So I don't necessarily do that. You know, I don't go stand in front of the Aria and hand stuff out. But like, you know, when
stream tonight.
Yeah. Get, you know, cheap tickets here. But if I, you know, if I do go out and play or whatever, I've made up business cards to give out and things like that. But a lot of it is your traditional sort of online marketing that you can't really avoid because it is an online platform. But I kind of just, like I said, I sort of get off on I enjoy building it more than I actually enjoy the results of of that building, if that makes any sense.
I mean, I get like the sense that I have, and I haven't really watched your stream all that much, but from having interacted, you know, or seen your tweets and that kind of thing, it seems like the the craft beers and the craft spirits tend to feature prominently in your brand identity.
Yeah, they definitely do, which I've said to a few people, like, I kind of regret a little bit. Not in any way because, like, oh, I think it's bad or that it takes away from the poker or anything like that. But I think that people build up an expectation of what they're going to see when they come to your stream. And if they don't get that, they're kind of a little bit disappointed. So, you know, if you don't, you know, if they're like, hey, you know, KB, do a shot with me or whatever. And I'm like, I'm kind of good for now, you know. Like, I had too many last night or whatever. They're like, oh, man. So I've been trying to find ways to moderate that a little bit. Again, and part of it is just like when I first started doing it, it was kind of like, you know, once a week or whatever. But as I started to stream more and more, I was kind of like, well, this is like starting to borderline on maybe unhealthy. You know, like you can't really just drink 5-6 nights a week and expect to not to be, you know, bad results. And, you know, I'm not 21 anymore. So it's like at some point I have to start to think about the fact that I don't want to really like die on stream or anything. So. So I'm bringing that back a little bit, but it's there and will always be there. And I mean, the reality is like I want it to be, to some degree, I want it to be a representation of what I'm really like. And the reality is I do have a beer on a, you know, probably a more regular occasion than most people. So I don't want to like hide that fact or anything, but it doesn't mean I'd have to have 8. It's okay to just have, you know, have one at night and then relax.
I actually had sort of a they grew up so fast moment when you mentioned your son being in, or I guess being almost out of college or you know, senior year of college. Just because I have recollections of you posting on Twitter or Facebook or whatever about, you know, road trips you were doing with him and stuff like that. And I was like, wait, he's in college? Wait, he's out of college? Like, he grew up very quickly just now in my head.
Yeah, last time you came on the show, you were proud of him for doing a Minecraft YouTube channel, and that was a high school project. Like, that was just something he was doing in high school.
That's right. Yeah, it is weird. Like, I mean, like I said, it went by so fast. And now, granted, he did sick dad brag. He's finishing a semester early, so it did go by a little quicker because it was less than normal. But yeah, it went by so fast, and like, I don't know where that time went, but yeah, for dads out there, I know it's cliche, but enjoy it while it lasts because they're out of the house really fast. I mean, there are still a lot of positives to that too, like especially the being out of college part because makes the bills a lot less every month. But yeah, he's doing really well, and you know, he's already starting to like apply for jobs in the real world and stuff. And I'm like, whoa, that's pretty crazy. So I'm preparing myself mentally. So he's been with the same girlfriend too for over 4 years because they went to prom together. So, you know, me and my wife are starting to prepare ourselves for we're getting married and then we're having a baby and you're going to be a grandpa. I'm not sure I'm ready for that conversation, but I'm sure it's not that far around the corner.
Congratulations to the extent that that's in order.
Well, hopefully not for a while, but
I get just on raising a fine young man, Derek.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. Most of the credit goes to my wife.
So we talked about marketing yourself on Twitter. I guess you're doing a lot of the marketing for Tournament Poker Edge as well. How do you think about distinguishing them in the, I mean, it's getting to be sort of a crowded training, you know, not just training videos, but there's so many different sources of poker information out there. How do you think about, you know, the identity of Tournament Poker Edge?
Yeah, it's something we've talked about a lot recently as things continue to develop. You know, it's kind of amazing. I was thinking about this a few days ago, actually, that like some of the sites that we sort of envied and in many ways wanted to like, not necessarily be, but the ones we wanted to beat, I guess is a better way to say it. You know, we've seen a lot of these sites go away, like Card Runners and Poker X Factor and all these different training sites that, I mean, we were just hoping to like be, you know, a quarter of what any of those were, and we've somehow managed to outlast many of them. But now new ones have popped up, and it's getting busier and busier. And like you said, it's really not even necessarily the training site market, but it's YouTube, it's Twitch, it's, you know, just Skype coaching and one-on-one coaching is becoming more and more prevalent. So it's interesting to see that whole space develop, and it's in many ways fun to try to think of how to survive in a ever-growing market. So what we've kind of realized is that we really need to get back to kind of what made TPE what it was in the first place. We kind of like, we grew TPE really based on more on the community aspect of what we do, even more so, honestly, than the poker content. And I think we've gotten away from that a little bit. And, you know, I'm very open and honest about this kind of stuff. So, like, you know, a perfect example is, like, our, you know, our podcast, we just haven't been good about doing it. Like, like sometimes it comes out every 6 months. Sometimes we'll do two in a month. Sometimes it goes 3 months. So we're working on improving that schedule. We have some plans for that. And I really want to get back to, again, like I said, like, people used to comment all the time, man, it's so cool that you guys, like, you're in the forums talking with us, and you're, you know, you come to tournaments and do events and hang out with us and stuff like that. And I think we've gotten away from that a little bit. So I think that's going to be something that people will see us getting back to a lot more, you know, the rest of this year and then early in the next year.
Nice. How about in terms of adding new instructors to the site? I don't even want to try to list the ones who have been added since you were first on the show, because I don't want to leave people out. But what are you looking for there? You know, when you're thinking about bringing in a new video creator, what kinds of things are you looking for on that resume?
Yeah, there's kind of a few things. Like I've said, you know, I've always told people, like, you can have one really good aspect to yourself as an instructor that will, you know, get you the job, so to speak. You know, so you could be an incredible teacher, right? You don't even have to be that good at poker, but you're just that good of a teacher, and you understand the concepts that, you know, you can explain them, and we might be interested. Or you might just be amazing at you know, the sickest poker player on the planet, but you're not that great of a teacher. We'd probably still be interested. And sort of likewise, like, you might just be a huge, you know, like, a huge personality. I don't know. Like, I won't name any names, but, like, if you're the big, you know, if you're the most Googled poker player, we'd probably be interested in talking to you. But obviously the best is when you have a lot of those things mixed into one. So yeah, we've started to add a lot of new people. I mean, when TPE started, it was basically like a group of friends, you know, there were basically seven of us or whatever. And it was kind of me and Diego on the business side and five poker players. But we kind of quickly realized that we needed to expand that and bring new blood in. And so we've kind of continued to try to refresh things a little bit. And we, you know, we've brought in Assassinato lately, and Colin Moshman, and Jason Smith, and a few other people along those lines, to just kind of like sort of keep the content fresh. Because I think even if you're presenting new content all the time or new concepts, eventually people want to hear a new voice or see a new face. Yeah. Well, so we try to do that.
As someone who's been making videos for you for a long time, I definitely find it difficult to keep things fresh. You know, to feel like, wait, I've already made videos saying essentially, I mean, of course, to some degree, like, the way I'm thinking about stuff changes or whatever, but it is hard to avoid just like repeating yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of guys find that. In fact, it's like, I mean, testament to you, honestly, that you've continued to churn out such good content, because there's plenty of guys, and I'm not going to name any names, who just kind of like fizzled out on their own, you know, not because we didn't want them anymore, but they were just like, I don't really know what to say anymore, you know? And they're like, yeah, I'm going to take a little break or whatever. And then 2 years goes by and they haven't made a video, and that's totally fine. I mean, I'm not criticizing anyone for that. I mean, hell, I have trouble coming up with new ideas. You know, sometimes a instructor will ask me, like, hey, you know, what would be a good idea for my next series? Like, what's a good concept? And I'm like, man, I don't know. we've done 2,000 videos. And it also doesn't help. Like, a lot of times we'll get messages from people saying, hey, can you do something on, like, super progressive knockouts, or, you know, some other like variant that maybe somebody like PokerStars has or something. And I'm like, what is that? Because I can't play on those sites. I don't know what you're talking about.
I've got a super progressive knockout video on there. Serious.
Boom. Plug. Links are in the show notes. Or whatever they say in real podcasts. I never use that phrase. I don't make show notes, but So it's a constant challenge to keep things fresh and updated. But I think we've done a fairly good job. And we get a lot of, you know, we do get a lot of positive feedback about some of the new guys. So it's been a fun ride. And I think we have some ideas for new, not just new like instructor types, but new content types that we hopefully will get to roll out in the future.
What's it like doing all this part-time? You know, you've got that new job you were talking about, and it seems like you have other things going on. It's is it a challenge to run a business part-time?
It wasn't for a long time because the other jobs that I were doing were so part-time. But, you know, I used to work, even the brewery stuff, I guess, came after the last time I was on the show. So for people who don't know, like, for a long time I just did TPE, and then at some point I decided to get involved in the craft beer business, and it was going to be a very, very, like, part-time job. Like, basically it was 1 hour a day. But that 1 hour quickly turned into two, and then four, and then six. And that became a real challenge, for sure. And then I left that job when I moved to Vegas, and then suddenly everything seemed so easy again. You know, it was like, oh, nobody's calling me about the beer business. All I have to do is focus on TPE all day, every day. So I'm enjoying that while it lasts, because once I get back to North Carolina and start working with a distillery, of course, it's going to get busy again. And so, I mean, I guess, long answer short, it is a challenge, but it's one that I kind of always knew that's the way it was going to be. Like, when I started TPE, I had a job. So I knew it was always a quote-unquote side hustle, but it's like one that I enjoy. So, like, you know, even if I have to work 8 hours a day on, well, you know, whatever my day job is or whatever, it doesn't bother me to go watch a couple movies with the wife and then start working at 10 and finish at 3 a.m. and working on TPE, because it's not, I don't feel like I'm going back to work. I just kind of feel like, oh, this is, you know, I get to go do that poker thing that I like to do. So I can't create any new time in the day, but it doesn't make me think less of the time that I do spend on TPE, I guess.
Right.
That seems like a nice way to be able to structure your life.
Yeah, it's good. It's like, I mean, I know that my wife would prefer that I, you know, went to bed at the same time as her every night, or or got up at the same time, or, you know, would go for more walks or whatever. But I actually, she might not, because the dogs don't like it when I'm in the bed, but they'll sleep with her. So she actually prefers that. But yeah, I don't know. This is kind of what I often think, like, how long am I going to want to do this? Just from am I going to be like the 60-year-old guy, like, playing poker on Twitch and doing Tournament Poker Edge podcasts and stuff like that? Like, I don't really see that in my future. So part of me is kind of like, let's just enjoy the shit out of this while we can. Yeah. I retire off at the sunset, it'll be perfect.
It's interesting. I think you hit on something that's really important, which is that, like, you really do get to choose your hobbies. And if you really like watching a lot of television, you know, that's your choice. But, you know, it's also possible to choose a hobby that's also a part-time job or enriching in some other way. I'm often accused of being extremely productive, and I'm not sure if that's true. But I do try to have hobbies that, you know, I guess, have outputs that some people describe as productivity. I think that's made my life a lot better. I don't know if you would describe your life that way.
Yeah, I think I would. Like, I don't have a lot of things that I do that I consider sort of like wasted time. You know, like, I don't, and this is not, you know, hey, if you play Fortnite 5 hours a day and you love it, then you should definitely do that. But I'm not a video gamer, you know, like, I don't spend a ton of time watching television. My only real, like, unproductive vice is that I love football. But, you know, that's 3-4 months out of the year and one or two days a week that I kind of waste doing something that's mindless or whatever. But beyond that, like, I the things I actually enjoy doing are things that I think are actually, like, good, productive activities or fruitful, you know, like, so, you know, we do a lot of, like, volunteer work with Eagle Rescue.
Sorry, and Nate, are you opening something in front of your microphone?
Not anymore.
Okay, great.
That's his check. His Thinking Poker podcast host check. So yeah, so like, you know, most of the time that I, when I have time to do something, it's usually on something that's fruitful, either financially or, I don't know, rewarding personally, like, you know, like volunteer work and things like that. So I try to kind of keep my life moving that way. It just makes me feel better, I guess, at the end of the day. Like, yeah. I hate those days where you kind of like end, you know, you're going to bed or whatever, you're like, wow, can't take that one back. wasted that one and it's gone. So, yeah, there's a lot of days. I mean, there's even days where I honestly don't even really feel like streaming, and but I'm kind of supposed to for whatever reason. Like, maybe I said I was going to stream that day, or like I have a private home game every Tuesday, so I kind of have to stream every Tuesday. And those days where I'm just like, man, I kind of would like to just watch Netflix or something tonight, but then I go, nah, I can do that like on the plane next time I'm flying somewhere or whatever. Like, let's do work today. So I always kind of force myself, and then I end up enjoying it. But it's just that it's getting started is always hard.
Yeah, I think there's that distinction between enjoying, like, things that you enjoy doing and things that you enjoy having done. And that second part is the, it can be difficult to motivate yourself for those.
Yes, yes, absolutely true. It's like running a marathon or something, you know? Like, halfway through it, you're hating life, but then when you finish, you're like, yes, I did it. Not that I know, because I've never run a marathon or a mile, for that matter, but I'm sure it's incredibly rewarding.
I have a friend who says he loved the Army just as soon as he got out of it.
Yeah, they probably like tell the stories fondly now about, you know, having to do push-ups in the mud or whatever, I don't know, whatever they do in the Army, but I'm sure at the time they wanted to kill somebody.
How did you get involved with the Beagle rescue stuff?
So we owned a Beagle for 18 years. Basically, my wife and I, before we were married, we adopted a Beagle in college, which is a terrible idea. I don't recommend it for anybody at that age, I mean. Probably when she was around 15 or so, my son left the gate to her house open, and she escaped. And she was missing for 2 weeks. And during that time, we had contacted a local Beagle rescue called Triangle Beagle Rescue and just said, hey, if anybody turns in a beagle, or is there anything you can do to help us in the search for our dog? And we ended up finding her eventually. And then several years later, when she passed away, we were trying to think of kind of a way to memorialize her or whatever. And so we made a donation to the rescue in her name, just because they had been so helpful. And then I think they returned, you know, they sent like a thank you card or whatever for the money. And with it was something along the lines of, you know, have you ever wanted to volunteer with a rescue? You know, here's all the information, go to this website or whatever. And so we did. And at first we just kind of like, I think we worked at some events or we made a few more donations or whatever. And then eventually we started fostering. We fostered our first dog. And then I think at some point we fostered a litter of puppies, and I think at that point my wife in particular got a little bit addicted. And next thing we knew, I think I'm not sure, my wife would know better than me, but I'm going to say we've probably fostered close to 200 beagles now, probably. Wow. Somewhere in that area. And my wife does all their social media and marketing and website stuff and event stuff, so she's actually on the board now, so we know we've gotten more involved, and she does most of the heavy lifting. But you know, when you have a dog, when you have a rescue dog in the house that isn't yours, it's kind of all the work is spread around pretty evenly. But it's a lot of fun. It's one thing that I'm very excited about getting back to North Carolina for, because we haven't been able to foster here because we're renting a house. So we're excited to get back and get way more involved in that again.
It's kind of nice.
Dog rescue is wonderful.
It's nice to hear, just from the perspective of someone who used to be more involved than I am now anyway in a nonprofit organization. I think that the kind of stuff like you mentioned, just having the advertisement in their thank you letter that they send you, I think that stuff gets kind of a bad rap sometimes. And understand, like, I know that there are companies who are like really obnoxious about it, and people don't like getting that mail, and they feel bad like throwing away the advertisements they get and stuff like that. But I think sort of like advertising and fundraising have such bad reputation among potential donors to nonprofit organizations.
Yeah.
Like they hate to see money going to that kind of stuff. They're like, don't spend money on advertising. I was like, well, right. I mean, advertising the service that we provide is, or even, like, I mean, in theory, I mean, a lot of mailers just actually, this is a whole separate subject, but I mean, whether or not mailers are actually plus EV is kind of a separate question. But in theory, they should be plus EV investments, in which case I don't think it necessarily makes that much sense to be so upset about organizations spending money. But anyway, where I'm going with this is I'm happy to hear that you had a positive experience stemming from a relatively unsolicited enticement from a nonprofit organization.
Yeah, I think a lot of times it's like you don't even really realize. I mean, I guess you kind of know those opportunities are available, but you just don't really know where to begin. Especially, you know, I mean, not to stereotype or anything, but if you're like, I don't know, if you're older and you just aren't super web savvy or whatever, like you might not even know where to start with getting involved with rescuing or fostering or any other sort of charitable ventures. So, you know, having your hand held a little bit, I guess, can be good in that regard. And it worked for us, so we're happy. We're happy that that happened. And it, you know, like I think a lot of people say about charitable work and stuff, I think it provides a real balance to your life, especially when you're in a quote-unquote career where you are constantly trying to take money from people. It's nice to every once in a while to be like, okay, yes, I took $1,000 from that dude today, but at least I returned the goodwill to some animals. So,
well, I think particularly in poker, you end up being, and I guess it's probably less true for you with, like, if you're not as heavily involved in the kind of live poker scene, but you get so surrounded by, like, especially the professional poker community, there's so much emphasis on having a lot of money, or people who spend money in sort of frivolous ways, or just kind of overprivileged people in a lot of different regards. And I think it's kind of a nice check to avoid fall. Like, I mean, there's a lot of people who, you know, when they do make a lot of money from poker, they change in ways that aren't necessarily good. And I always felt like my nonprofit work helped to, I don't know that I needed help being grounded, but helped to keep me grounded in that regard, to not kind of get lost in that world of thousands of dollars sort of changing hands so lightly.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I think one of the things that's cool too, and I hope other people see this in the poker world, like I kind of feel like there is more emphasis and more discussion about the poker community giving back and stuff. I don't know, you see like charities like Reg popping up, and disclaimer, I know very little about that charity, so don't just send them money because I mentioned them. I just use it as an example because it's an easy one. And I know like there's sort of this stigma on people like talking about their charitable work and stuff because people think they're trying to get, you know, a pat on the back or whatever. But I don't know. I just feel like I see a lot more stuff on Twitter about, or on Facebook or wherever, about people doing cool things from a charitable standpoint. There's a lot of it on Twitch. You know, a lot of people doing charity streams and giving a percentage of their Twitch revenue to certain charities and stuff like that. And by default, you kind of have to promote those things because you're promoting your charity stream or you're promoting your Twitch stream. So it seems to be a little bit contagious, and you kind of see other people picking up on it. And I think that's cool, you know. And hopefully it's something that people outside the poker world see about poker players as well. It's not. It's possible that it's just something that I see because I'm monitoring social media so closely, but I hope not.
You've actually hit on another one of my pet peeves, which is the you're giving people crap for like bragging about the charitable things that they do, which I think is, yeah. So I do understand it, and I do understand that many people are sort of insufferable, and the idea of someone sort of preening themselves and talking about what great people they are, like I fully understand why that kind of thing is distasteful. That said, I think there's a lot of plus EV to it. So for one thing, I think just like you're saying, the sort of social proof of it, of that it'll encourage other people to, oh crap, sorry, hang on a second, I gotta answer this phone call.
No problem.
Yeah, so why beagles specifically? I have a hound and love my hound, but you know, people get attached to breeds for different reasons. What was it just the work with this rescue, or do you have some affinity for beagles?
Initially, it was just because our first dog randomly was a... We didn't go adopt our first dog because it was a beagle. In fact, it's kind of funny. We went to the local shelter, and the only dog they had was a beagle, which is really weird. Yeah. So we were like, we'll take it. So initially it was just that, but then what kind of got us hooked on it was, you know, when we started working with this particular rescue, it became apparent very quickly that North Carolina in particular has a huge beagle problem, or not really a beagle problem, but it's more of a human problem, but, you know, yeah. There's a lot of hunters is basically what it is.
Yeah.
And when dogs aren't good hunters, they effectively just get kicked to the curb, sometimes yeah. literally, or left in the woods, or just locked in a pen and never fed or
yeah.
pet. So it kind of became something where it was just out of necessity, really, because there were just so many problems with it in North Carolina. And then when we got to Vegas, we looked for beagle rescues, and they're like, man, we can't even get... You know, we can't get beagles to rescue, like, which I guess is a good problem to have. But like, they actually will like fly in beagles from other states because those states are overcrowded, and Nevada is particularly not. So it was really just initially it was very random, and then it became a little less random once we realized what the extent of the challenge was.
Yeah. It's and also if you have things going on in life like hounds, you don't need to. They can be happy even if you're not running 10 miles a day with them. Like, they want love and they want you, but they don't need constant affection.
Yeah.
The way that some dogs do.
Yeah, and a lot of the big breeds too, like, need so much exercise, which my wife is an active person, but I'm not the one who's going to take a dog for three 2 mile walks, which some big breeds really need. So most beagles are, especially the ones we work with, many of them have just been kept in a cage their whole life, so they're just happy to be like around people. You know, they'll just sit in your lap, or sit under your feet, or whatever. And that, like you said, that's all they really care about until a rabbit goes by, and then that's all they care about.
that is our dog.
Yeah, hounds are great, though. I can't recommend them enough to people who are looking for a dog, especially if they have children. Like, they're so good with children.
Yeah. It's underrated dogs, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't want to interrupt you guys. Hi, back if you're if you were only killing time, but I've been enjoying the conversation.
A little of both.
You should talk about how it's actually like basically fine for people to talk about the money they've given to charity.
Yeah, so I think there's the social proof element of it where the companies that make these claims are often companies that are making money off of processing donations, so they should certainly be taken with a grain of salt. But you know, I have seen numbers that when you mention having made a donation on Facebook or Twitter or something like that, you know, I don't even know what the numbers are off the top of my head, but it generates like several additional dollars in donation from other people who are like, oh, that sounds like a good idea, I'll do that too. Or even if they don't donate immediately, just sort of putting the idea in their head of making donations, whether or not it's a donation to that particular organization, just sort of people seeing people in their peer group giving to charitable causes, I think makes them more likely to give. And then I also think it probably makes you more likely to give in the future if you brag about doing it. If you sort of start to identify as a person who gives to charitable organizations, especially if you get positive feedback from your social media followers or whatever, saying, oh, thanks for doing this, sounds like a great cause. Yeah. You get that little hit of dopamine, probably makes you more likely to donate in the future. So I think there is a lot that's kind of plus EV from a charitable perspective about bragging about your contributions, although I do understand why it rubs some people the wrong way.
Go ahead, Derek. Oh, I was just saying, I like, you pretty much summed up my beliefs on it perfectly. That's exactly how I feel.
Can I make a more cynical point?
Absolutely. That's why you're here.
Have you seen the, like, what's the alternative? Have you seen the average thing that people say on the internet? It's like, oh, I just gave money to a charity. Like, even if there's no value to it, like, is that more annoying or less contentful or less interesting than, like, the other thing that you were going to say instead? Or like, oh, man, that tweet, you know what? That tweet did not add a lot to my life. That is a terrible tweet. Like, really, it's worse than the other tweet? Like, I can't believe that. I just can't.
I think of that every year when a handful of my friends on Facebook complain about people posting pictures of their kids going back to school. There's always like one or two people who are like, okay, everybody, time to post all your stupid pictures of your kids.
Those pictures are great.
I love them. Like, I honestly, like, I look forward to seeing them every year, but I don't know. Maybe that just means I'm becoming like a weird old man or something. I don't know. But I love keeping up. That to me, that's the point of Facebook, is like to keep up with your friends and their families.
Well, it's particularly neat. You know, I'm friends with a lot of like Maryland area poker players who I don't even, I don't know them that well. I'm not really like friends with them. I may have barely even spoken to them at the table, but it's just once you get to be friends with some people in that group, then it recommends other people in their group and stuff like that. So it's just interesting to see what they're like, and I think pictures of their kids going to school and like seeing how they talk about their kids, and I just find all that sort of stuff, like getting to know as people these people that you just encounter as otherwise relatively anonymous people at the poker table, and they're like, oh look, that guy's got three kids and he likes them.
Far be it from me to ever criticize somebody for being like an active, loving parent. You know, like stop being so nice to your kids. Like you said, Nate, like the stuff I have to scroll through sometimes to get to, especially in our current political
situation. Political engagement can be good, right? But like the inevitable consequence, like if everybody started talking about crocheting tomorrow, the average comments about crocheting would become like much stupider, right? Because there's just not that much crocheting. And I understand like it's good to have an engaged population. Like I think it's good that people are paying attention to politics in a lot of ways. But like inevitably, the more people start talking about this one thing, you know, a lot of people who don't know a lot of, you know, it's like the Winter Olympics or whatever, where it's like, you call that a twizzle? Worst ice dancing I've ever seen, you know? And it's like, but like the problem is that like the Winter Olympics, you know, the Trump presidency is lasting longer than 2 weeks, it turns out.
Yeah, I guess every couple of years people go on their World Cup kick. And then they never talk about soccer again for 2 years. But I'll take the World Cup posts and the Winter Olympics posts over the
blue. Yeah, sure, you know, whatever. I'm just saying like, oh boy, you know, this Beagle Rescue is sure doing good work and I'm happy to have supported them. Like I would say that's above average.
Well, I'll keep them coming then.
Yeah.
No, shameless plug. I do my Beagle Rescue charity stream every November on Giving Tuesday, which is the 27th this year. So that's my shameless plug.
Yeah, I was a little offended last year. You didn't ask me to donate anything. I'll be offended if you
don't. Did I not? Stuff.
Yeah, you didn't. You didn't.
I will get at you this year for sure, because I really want to beat our record this year for money raised. So I'm gonna be. That's why I'm starting this early and already know the date, because I'm gonna. I'm going to hit up everybody I know, so both of you be ready.
I'm ready. Fantastic. And this is one other thing that I wanted to say about both donations and, you know, volunteering, including in the ways that you've ended up doing with the Beagle organization, which is like that's the single biggest driving factor of anyone becoming involved, whether as a donor or volunteer or anything else, is being asked by someone that they know, and also just being asked in general. So I guess you weren't really asked by someone that you knew, or maybe an organization that you were vaguely aware of, but I think in general the kind of spreading that around is particularly important. Okay, I'm done with that.
Yeah. But we can talk about charity all day, but I will throw out one more thing, which is interesting, which is there's this sort of there's a case recently where the Beagle Rescue we work with actually like spent a lot of money to fly to China and rescue 5 beagles from the Chinese dog meat trade, you know, where they actually eat the dogs, and they brought and some people criticized the rescue for, you know, spending $3,000 on a plane ticket and all this stuff to get these dogs back, but what they don't realize is the resulting press from that brought in the dogs were rescued within days because it was such a big story, and the press brought in so many new volunteers, so many new fosters, so much more money, and so yeah, not that charities are businesses, but in many ways they need to be run like one, because they function just like businesses. They need money to operate.
It's very strange, like people I'm stealing this from something I heard on maybe it's the A16Z podcast or something, but like nobody walks to a bakery and like starts screaming like, how much of the cost of this muffin did you spend on flour? I demand, you know. It's like they just like sort of see whether the muffin is worth a buck to them,
right?
And I don't know. It's like anyway. Good.
I'm actually going to have to run, guys, and I think I'm the one recording this, so that might have to be the end of the conversation.
Yeah.
No worries.
Anything else you want to plug, Derek? By the way, thanks for coming on.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been a while. I enjoyed it. I appreciate you guys, and I really enjoy the podcast. And I don't really have much to plug. I mean, you know, your listeners know about TPE, and now they know about Beagle Rescues and Twitch. So, not a lot to say. Go Dolphins, I guess. That's about it.
Well, pleasure as always, and let's be in touch. Hit me up, and see you later, Andrew.
All right, take care, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. Take care. Devotion of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.